From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with artist and author Françoise Gillot. An accomplished painter, Gillot was also famous in art circles for her 10-year relationship with Pablo Picasso. Also today, jazz singer and songwriter David Frischberg joins us at the piano and answers questions about his attorney, Bernie. We also have a song from African folk singer Tony Bird about the vanishing wildlife in his native Malawi. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone judges the judges of the Olympic Women's Figure Skating Championship. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Françoise Gillot met Pablo Picasso in 1943 during the German occupation of France. She was 21, and she says she already felt that painting was her whole life. But she made room in her life for Picasso. Whereas she was just getting established, he was already one of the best-known artists in the world. He was also three times her age. Their relationship lasted more than 10 years, and they had two children, Claude and Paloma. Gillot wrote about that decade in her book Life with Picasso. Many things have changed in her life since she left him. She now lives in the United States with her husband Jonas Salk, but painting is still at the center of her life. A retrospective of her work recently premiered at the Picasso Museum in France, and a new book about her painting has just been published, titled An Artist's Journey. It includes reproductions of paintings from throughout her career. I spoke with Françoise Gillot from the NPR studios in New York. I asked her to elaborate on something that she wrote in her new book. She says, "As a painter, I have become more or less a loner, because when I was younger, I knew so many painters that afterwards I got indigestion."
Well, it's simple. It's straightforward enough, I think. It means that at the beginning of my career as an artist, I was able to meet, you know, the great painters of almost two generations before mine, and even just one generation before mine. And I got, you know, it was very important, very interesting. But after that, when I was more than 30 years old, I thought I had enough input to last for a lifetime, and I really didn't want to start, you know. After that, I wanted to develop on my own.
So did you basically cut yourself off from...
No, I did not, but I mean, I just started also to travel a great deal. I had a studio in London in the 60s, and then after that in the 70s, started to come to New York. And I did meet some of the artists of the New York School, like Gottlieb and Motherwell and a few others. But what I mean is that not that I did not see other artists, but I did not get involved in theoretical discussions as I had been previously.
Did that desire to be independent have anything to do with your leaving Paris?
Well, maybe, yes. I think that in Paris, the artists are closer to one another, and they have that habit of meeting in the evening when everybody has finished work, you know, in one cafe or a restaurant like the Coupole, and then rediscussing as if you are rediscussing, you know, the war after it has been fought already. And I really didn't feel that I needed any of that anymore.
When you left Paris, did it change the kinds of colors you used in your paintings? Being exposed to a different geography?
No, I would say, well, of course, first of all, you know, as I tell you, I lived in London. I had a studio in Chelsea, and I like England a lot. I used to go to England when I was a child, and England for me is a good source of inspiration. I also went to Greece and worked, and I didn't really work in Greece. I just took notes and did a lot of canvases about Greece when I was either in England or in Paris. What I mean is simply that Paris for me is a marvelous city. I was born there. I was brought up there. I always like to go there. But maybe I am a citizen of the world. I like to be somewhere else as well.
Your first painting show was in 1943 during the German occupation of France. Were the Nazis basically acting as curators during that period? Did you have to pass any kind of German editorial control before you were allowed to have a show?
Yes, that was not only my case. It was the same thing for any other painter. You couldn't have an exhibition in Paris at that time without a kind of commission of German officers or intellectuals who came to visit the show before the day of the opening. And then if they said, yes, it can be open, then it was open. Otherwise, all the paintings would be put down on the floor and you could not exhibit. So that's the reason why, even though I wanted to make a statement, you know, about my feelings of the time, I did it in a symbolic manner.
And the symbolism went right past the Germans who were
That's
reviewing
right.
your paintings?
In the same way as many writers, for example, like Jean-Paul Sartre, play at that play, The Flies, you know, which was supposedly inspired by ancient Greece, and many others like Jean Anouilh did Antigone, etc. So by taking oblique ways, we could also make strong commentaries on the present time. But we couldn't do it without being a little bit oblique. But the French people quite understood what we were saying.
Did you ever go through a period during the war of thinking that, that painting was a kind of trivial pursuit during such a time?
No, I was very young. As you know, I was 21 in 43 when I had my first exhibition. And I had decided that I wanted to fight for French culture, or for, let's say, the values, to uphold the values of what I consider to be civilization against what I consider not to be civilization.
It was during...
And a totalitarian ideology which I strongly opposed. There are many ways to oppose something. You know, you can oppose it fighting... I thought that was not the strongest point I could make, so I wanted to fight with my own tools.
It was during that first show that you met Pablo Picasso and started your relationship together. Now, you were 21 and he was 62, and you were a beginning painter. He was a world-famous painter. Were there a lot of obstacles in proving your seriousness in painting to him and to his friends, since they were already so well established?
Well, you know, since it was during that period of the Nazi occupation, things were absolutely different. They were not tall as it became after the liberation. At that time, there were very few people seeing very few people, and the people were in opposition to the Germans were not that many. You know, after that, everybody was in agreement with Picasso. At that time, I can tell you, he didn't have that many friends. So I was among the people who befriended him at a time when it was difficult to do so.
Picasso told you to study Cubism, did you?
Yes, I did, but I didn't need his advice for that because I knew about it already.
What were the ideas of Cubism that interested you as a painter?
Well, a new vision of space devoid of perspective.
Was it hard to paint when you were living with him, knowing that he'd be looking at your paintings? I mean, I could see two sides of this, you know, living with someone who's already
well-established and brilliant at what he does.
Yeah,
but what you forget is that in France at that time, I was considered a prodigy myself. So, in fact... I didn't have any type of inferiority feeling at all. I knew, I mean, he was extremely well known, but he was 40 years my senior, and I was one of the young painters who were most known in my own generation. So, you know, I mean, I don't think that those things are seen by people from an external point of view. I could see it from my own point of view, which was that I had confidence in myself, and his career had nothing to do with mine. It was already done, and mine lied in the future. So it didn't. If I had felt ill at ease, I would not have gone that way. I felt perfectly at ease with Pablo, and he was made me also feel perfectly at ease. Otherwise, there would have been no point in a relationship like that.
Yeah, I guess I'm always interested in what happens when...
You know, I mean, it's very funny because people always imagine that when people who are sometimes very famous are really, I mean, they are already bored with that. And what they want is to live and to meet people who have their own ideas, and not people who are stupid admirers and sycophants. So he was interested in me because I was an independent person, and I have my own ideas and my own way to paint, etc. That was interesting to him. If I had been just one more sycophant, he would not have been interested in me even 5 minutes.
I should say here, though, that you quote him in your book about the period of life you spent with him, life with Picasso. You quote him as saying that women are either goddesses or doormats.
Yeah, but that's what he meant, because I was a goddess, not a doormat.
But sometimes, I don't know, sometimes it seems that some men who really like goddesses want to fall in love with a goddess and then turn them into their doormat. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, there's also a perversity that is true. And I think Picasso was very perverse as well. But I don't think I let him go that route with me, and that's why finally I left. Sure. I always told him that he shouldn't try certain games with me because it wouldn't work out. So that's all I can say.
Painter Françoise Gillot is my guest, and she's written a new book with reproductions of many of her paintings. It's called An Artist's Journey. You, through Picasso, met Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, and you described your first meeting with them as the equivalent of taking oral exams.
Exactly.
Did they interrogate you? Or what was that like?
Yeah, it lasted the whole afternoon, you know, and they asked me all kinds of questions to see, you know, the extent of my culture, both literary and art history-wise, which was, I thought, a little bit absurd, but I answered their questions because I thought it was rather funny in a way.
You know, it's been years since I read Gertrude Stein's The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, but one of the things I really remember from it was that at all the dinners that they gave, that the men who were, for the most part, the artists, and Gertrude Stein would kind of be in one part of the room or sit at one table, and then the wives and Alice B. Toklas would hang out, you know, in another part of the room. Is that, now, The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas is set a few decades before you met Stein and Toklas.
Yeah, that was mostly before the First World War, when I was not yet born.
But was it that way when you used to go to their house?
No, you see, I went to their house once.
Oh, just once?
And and Alice B. Toklas took a strong dislike for me right away. But Gertrude Stein, the opposite. And after that, each time I tried to visit them at the house, then Alice Toklas said Gertrude was not there, and then Gertrude started to, with her dog Basket, meet me at Rue de Bussy 11 o'clock each morning. I would talk with her for an hour, almost until her death. So I got to know her pretty well, and we were talking about literature and painting together alone, without Pablo and without Alice. So I never went there again in their house. So I don't know how she received other people. Don't forget, she died in 1946. She was already quite ill, and I think it was a pleasure for her to speak with a young person who was interested in both in literature and painting.
Do you have any ideas about why Alice B. Toklas didn't take to you at all?
No, she was jealous of me.
Oh. You know Simone de Beauvoir as well. Did you have talks with her about the kinds of issues that she later wrote about in The Second Sex?
No, I didn't really like Simone de Beauvoir at all, so I didn't talk much with her.
Oh, how come?
No, well, you know, you have your likes and dislikes. I didn't like Simone de Beauvoir as a person. I liked her as a writer, but not as a person. Sartre was very, very pleasant and very open, but Simone de Beauvoir was rather, apropos of being difficult with women, even though she professed to be a starch feminist, she was impossible with other women.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, as you say.
Now, for the period of time when you lived with Picasso, you weren't married, right?
Yes, that's right.
Was that...
I thought it even was better that way, because that way I was independent. Otherwise, if I had been married to him, then he could have treated me any way he wanted, whereas being free, I could make my point of being still independent even though I was there, and that it was up to me to still be there or not there if I wanted.
That's a point I can really appreciate.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the real point that made my was possible for me to have my own independence, freedom, and dignity.
But this is a concept that's much more accepted now than it was in the 1940s when you met.
I don't care. I was ahead of my time for many things, not only for painting.
So you must have been really pretty. I was going to say brave, but I guess it didn't take that much courage because you didn't care about that kind of opinion of you.
No, I didn't care about people's opinion, and I still don't. I do what I think is the right thing to do in my own way, and then I do it. And if people are against what I do, that's their problem, not mine, so to speak.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your work, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Françoise Gillot. Her new book is titled An Artist's Journey. We'll be back in a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Françoise Gillot is my guest. Her new book, An Artist's Journey, features many reproductions of her paintings. Her previous book is titled Life with Picasso. Just a couple of other things I wanted to ask you about, you know, the earlier part of your life. I know when you were with Picasso and when you were starting to get dissatisfied and restless, he told you that what you need is a baby and that it's good for a woman's nature. It settles her down. It puts her more in touch with nature. You had a baby, and then he complained that his life was getting too domestic. Did that drive you crazy, that he had been the one really suggesting having children, and then he would say that it was tying him down?
Yes, well, in a way, both assertions were true. You know, if you are objective about it, that is a kind of black humor I could take, because I can also myself see things in more than one way. Life is multifaceted. At the time, I was a bit bitter because I didn't I'm pleased I have my children now, but at that time, I didn't really want to have children, especially given the circumstances. And I also knew he was doing that to tie me down, as he said.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I still thought that maybe in him, you know, love and tenderness would come to dominate the other parts of himself. But I wanted to give him everything he possibly could want, because I loved him very much. So I thought, if I fail because I've not been giving enough, that would really be very sad. If I fail because I've gave all, I will have no regrets.
How much did you sacrifice your own painting to put time into his life?
I didn't have to sacrifice my own paintings. Mm-hmm. I was working as much as he did. What I had to sacrifice was my time of sleep or any or my own emotions many times. But I managed to work, to care of the children. And, you know, after all, he was very affluent. We had servants too.
Mm-hmm. When you decided to leave the relationship, he told you that people will never be interested in you just for yourself. And when they're interested in you, it will only be a kind of curiosity that they will have about a person whose life has touched Picasso's life so intimately.
Yeah, that I put in the book because I found it interesting from the point of view of his own psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, he forgot completely that I was 40 years younger, that I was a very beautiful woman as well as intelligent and gifted, and that all the people of my own generation were waiting for me to come back to them. So that it's the opposite that was true. As soon as I left him, my real life started, you see. So I put that in the book, you know, without explaining why. Because I didn't want that book to be a panegyric on me. So I just put his view of the thing without saying what I thought of it, you see. Because he said, this will be the end of your life, when in fact it was the beginning of my life.
You said the people of your generation.
Don't forget, I call this book Life with Picasso, not My Life, because it was just life with Picasso, meaning life in general, the other people around him, which I don't talk much about myself in that book, you see. In fact, it's not my biography at all. It's a part of his biography. My biography starts rather afterwards.
You said the people of your generation were waiting for you to return
to
them.
That's right.
Now, you were 21 and he was 62 when you met.
No, but when I left him, I was 31 and was still very young. And then I got married a year later to a painter of my own generation, Luc Simon, who has a lot of talent. He's not known in the United States, but he's quite well known in Europe. And all my other friends, whom I had not seen during the Picasso period, because I thought that it would spoil everything. So what I did during the Picasso period is to see his friends and not involve my friends in anything linked with him. Because I had a feeling it would not last forever, you see, that he was such a paradoxical person, etc., that I thought I could uphold certain things because I'm very strong, but I didn't want to involve people of my own generation where we perhaps were not quite mature enough.
You're in your 60s now.
Yes.
Being at your age, close to the age that he was when you started your relationship, can you imagine, does the gap in the ages that you were take on a different perspective now that you're older?
What do you mean by that? Do you mean that at my age I would like to have a young man in my life like that? I don't think I would.
No, I guess I'm asking, does it seem like a bigger gap now that you're older, than it seemed like when you were younger?
Well, I don't know. I don't think about it that much. I cannot say.
Okay. My guest is Françoise Gillot, who's written a new book about her painting, and the book includes many reproductions of her paintings. It's called An Artist's Journey. Now, you said your life began after you left.
Because you see, before Picasso, I was living with my family, and my father was a very domineering person as well, even though he was also highly gifted and very intelligent. And it was very difficult for me to assert myself. And then after that, with Pablo, it was a bit of the same problem. So I can really say that even though I learned a lot from both of them, I really started my own personal life after I left Pablo.
As far as future relationships, did you have almost a set of guidelines of what you would and would not be willing to sacrifice the next time you got involved with someone?
Oh, no, I am not a person like that. I am very spontaneous, and I think life has to be lived as for the first time every day.
Mm-hmm.
And you must not keep a part of yourself aloof. Otherwise, you are like a statue, not like a person, in your human behavior. I think it's good to be generous in life. Life is generous with you if you are generous with life.
I know that during part of your life you've been an insomniac and have had great difficulty sleeping at night. Is that still the case?
Yes, but it's an advantage because that's how I succeeded in doing so much in my life, you see.
Working at night?
Yeah.
But aren't you tired during the day?
No, during the day I work.
So really, how many hours of sleep do you get?
Oh, well, you know, if I want to sleep more, I can, but if I have two, I can sleep 4 or 5 hours and be very pleased.
It seems to me, you know, as you said earlier, that you got indigestion from being with so many artists and then you wanted to be on your own. It seems to me you've really, in a way, divorced yourself from different schools of art. Your work has gone through different periods, but it hasn't been in sync with the schools of the day.
No, you see, that's what I really learned in that first phase. Never again belong to a group. That's what I said in this book, I think. Because in a group, some people are always the leaders and they always want the others to conform. And I am a non-conformist. I want to conform only to my own self and the deep desires that motivate me as an artist. And I couldn't care less about whether the others are going that route or not. Ultimately, if I have lived my life as an artist right, my work, which I call the artist's journey, which is a kind of pilgrimage, you know, toward my own center, my own being, is that's what the only thing that is important. And after all, I have enough following as it is, so I think I did the right thing.
Do you have people who have who prodigies who you've taken under your wing to teach what you know too much in the same way that other more established people taught you a lot when you were coming of age?
Well, I thought of that, and for about 7 years, I gave courses at USC summer campus in Idlewild. USC is University of Southern California. And I gave a course that was lasting about a month and was like a semester, but I would have my students with me all day long, sharing my life, you see. And I did that for about 7 years. I thought that was enough, so it's done. I was pleased to have young people with me, but I was mostly trying to help them develop their own capacities and not teaching them my way of thinking or my way of seeing. I don't believe in that.
You're married to Jonas Salk now, and he's a scientist, you're an artist. To a lot of people, the worlds of science and art are very, very far apart, but others say that they're really very close and that scientists, like artists, really operate on intuition and on hunches. What do you think?
Well, I think that a creative scientist is very much like a creative artist. The field is different, but the way of thinking and the creative process is basically the same.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your work. I should ask you, do you have any shows coming up that we should know about?
I have the retrospective that was at the Picasso Museum in Antibes in September. We'll go now to the museum at Hofstra University in Hempstead starting on April the 24th. And then it will tour several places, several museums in the United States for 2 years after that.
Françoise Gillot has written a new book about her painting, titled An Artist's Journey. The book includes many reproductions of her work. It's published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with George Cadwallader. He's the founder of the Penikese Island School for Delinquent Teenage Boys. The island has no electricity or running water, and the boys face issues of basic survival in hopes that it will straighten them out. But Cadwallader has found that around 80% of them return to crime after they leave. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Not just anyone can write a song made up entirely of the names of baseball players. David Frischberg can and did. Coming up, Frischberg plays a few of his songs and talks about his career as a jazz pianist, singer, and songwriter. Folk singer and guitarist Tony Bird also has a song. It's inspired by life in Africa, in his native Malawi. And critic at large Laurie Stone looks back on the recent Winter Olympics and how the athletes in women's figure skating had to overcome both the difficulty of their routines and the narrow minds of the judges. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. Secretary of State George Shultz presented a formal proposal for negotiations to Middle East leaders today. Shultz is ending the first round of his Middle East shuttle mission. Meanwhile, two more Palestinians were shot and killed in violence in Israeli-occupied territories. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
One Palestinian was killed in the northern part of the occupied territories. An 18-year-old Palestinian was killed near the town of Bethlehem. Violence continued today after the Israeli military banned foreign and Israeli reporters from the major towns in the occupied West Bank. U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz left Israel today after delivering written details for peace negotiations. Shultz asked Israel's Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir for a definite response when Shamir travels to Washington in the middle of this month. According to Israeli radio, the Prime Minister has already expressed some reservations to key elements in the Shultz plan. His coalition partner, Shimon Peres, is pushing for a decision in a cabinet meeting this week before the Shamir trip to Washington. In Jerusalem, this is Deborah Amos.
A federal judge today said Pat Robertson will be allowed to drop his libel suit against former Congressman Pete McCloskey, but the judge in the case said the Republican presidential hopeful must first pay McCloskey's legal costs. Robertson said he doesn't want to go ahead with the $35 million suit because trial is set to begin on Super Tuesday. He says McCloskey's claim that Robertson used his father's influence to escape combat during the Korean War is not true. Robertson has until Monday to decide whether to end the legal action. Vice President George Bush holds a big lead in the opinion polls on the eve of the Republican presidential primary in South Carolina. A Washington Post survey shows Bush with a 49-26% lead over his nearest rival, Robert Dole. A panel of top scientists and engineers today said the space shuttle is much safer now than it was 2 years ago and should be ready for launch in August. But as NPR's Richard Harris reports, the panel criticized NASA for taking the wrong approach to figuring out how to make the shuttle even safer.
Right now, NASA doesn't have a rigorous program for figuring out which safety problems are most important, so the agency has reviewed thousands of critical parts, and it's trying to fix all of them as best they can. A panel of experts assembled by the National Academies of Sciences and Engineering says that instead, NASA should analyze the risk of disaster the way engineers do it for things like nuclear power plants and fighter planes. This involves calculating the odds that a particular part will fail, and then figuring out how serious the consequences would be. That way, the space agency would have a way to identify the most important safety problems and to focus attention on those. The panel did an analysis of the shuttle O-rings, the parts that failed in the Challenger accident. Panel Chairman General Alton Slay said that if NASA had done that same assessment and reached the same conclusions, they probably wouldn't have launched Challenger. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The Federal Aviation Administration today cited Northwest Airlines for a number of safety violations, which include operating aircraft in an unairworthy condition. The report found 139 violations of federal or company standards. Mort Edelstein is a spokesman for the FAA.
The report contains about 139 findings. Some may be violations of the FAA regulations. Others involve apparent noncompliance with approved company procedures and good operating practices.
The FAA says the report follows a routine inspection of the Minneapolis-based carrier and is not related to a Northwest crash that killed 156 people last year. It looks like mailing a letter will soon cost 25 cents. The Independent Postal Rate Commission today recommended a series of postage increases, including raising the price of a first-class stamp by 3 cents. A final decision must come from the Postal Service's Board of Governors, but it requested the changes. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 5 points to close the week at 2057.86. Declines led advances in trading of 201 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Singer and guitarist Tony Bird joins us today for our weekly performance spot. Tony has lived in New York City for the past 12 years, but he's a native of Malawi, a small country in southeastern Africa that got its independence in 1964. Tony is going to sing us a song about the bush and the wildlife in his country.
When I grew up in Africa, I only had to hop through the garden hedge to be in the bush. The bush starts where the town ends, and I just grew up in small towns. And there was a place not very far from the garden hedge called the Dambo. And this is a local term in Malawi for a wet, marshy area with a little waterhole. And of course, it was a popular place for the animals, the wild animals, to come to drink and graze. In those days, there was still quite a lot of wildlife on the edges of the towns, on the outskirts. In fact, occasionally lions would wander down onto the local golf course and nibble at the flags. Anyway, this song is a description of the beauty of the savanna bushland, the long grass and the savanna trees, forest. And not only just in Africa, but in general all over the world, wildlife is being threatened, you know. This song is trying to say, let's save the wildlife and let's save ourselves in the process. Down in the Dambo.
Out in the bush veld, just a dream away. Where the long grass shines in the brightest day. Where the silence drifts and life is slow. Down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo where the long grass grows. Down in the Dambo where the orchids glow. Where I love to be, baby, waters flow. Where the game runs free as the breeze that blows. Down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo where the long grass grows. You may see a leopard or a lion or the rainbirds flying or a herd of a blue gnu. Or the buffalo graze and the elephants bathe down in the hippo pool. Or the shy kudu and the giraffe loom, gazelles and the rhino roam. Down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo where the long grass grows. Out in the bush veld, near Masasi Glades, to the fever trees in Mimosa Day. Life's meaning lives in a wild man's bones. Down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo where the long grass grows. I hope and pray that we can save our wild world from a lasting grave. For we know ourselves by our wild abode. Down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo where the long grass grows. You may see a leopard, a lion, or the rainbirds flying, or a herd of a blue gnu. Or the buffalo graze and the elephants bathe down in the hippo pool. Or the shy kudu and the giraffe loom, gazelles and the rhino roam. Down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo where the long grass grows. So may our eyes forever gaze upon this world as a sacred place. For without its life, will I have no home. Down in the Dambo, down in the Dambo where the long grass grows. Will we see? Will we see I hope we still see. A leopard, a lion, or the rainbows flying, or a herd of a blue gnu, or the buffalo graze and the elephants bathe down in the hippo pool, or the shy kudu and the giraffe loom, gazelles and the rhino roam. Down in the Dumbo, down in the Dumbo, down in the Dumbo, down in the Dumbo, down in the Dumbo where the long grass grows. Down in the Dumbo where the long grass grows.
Tony Bird recently opened for a concert by Ladysmith Black Mambazo in Boston, and he's making club appearances around the U.S. and in Canada. This is Fresh Air. My guest is jazz singer, songwriter, and pianist David Frischberg. You can tell a Frischberg song by the clever lyrics, and a Frischberg performance by the repertoire, a blend of Irving Berlin, Frank Lesser, Duke Ellington, and of course David Frischberg. And you can hear all of the above on his new album, Can't Take You Nowhere. We hooked up with David Frischberg from the NPR station KUOW in Seattle. He was at the piano. I asked him to begin by playing his song, My Attorney Bernie.
I'm in touch with my attorney Bernie. In a clutch, he can speed right to the scene. And if I'm locked up in the jail with just one phone call for my bail, he says to call his club collect or deal directly with his answering machine. And when I dine with my attorney Bernie, he buys wine from the rare imported rack. That's 'cause Bernie is a purist, not your polyester tourist. Bernie waves the glass around a while, then takes a sip and always sends it back. Bernie tells me what to do. Bernie lays it on the line. Bernie says we sue, and Bernie says we sign. We sign. Dotted line.
Is there a story behind how you wrote that song?
Well, not a very interesting one, but I'll tell. But there is a story, yeah. A friend of mine named Tim Brown in Minneapolis was celebrating his 25th year with the firm and invited my wife and me to come to Minneapolis for the big party. And in Tim's honor, I wrote the song. He invited me to entertain at the party, actually, and so I wrote the song for that. So the first audience was a group of lawyers. They smiled.
I'm sure
they smiled wanly.
Is it helpful to have some kind of occasion to inspire a song?
It's very helpful. I don't have a few spontaneous ideas or inspirations, and most of my impetus from my working comes from probably guilt.
Guilt that you haven't written enough?
Yeah, guilt and fear.
fear that I can't write anymore.
You actually have a great song about writer's block.
Yeah, I have got a lot of songs about guilt, too.
I think one of your most unconventional lyrics is your song Van Lingle Mungo. And the whole lyric is like names of baseball players?
Yes, it is. It certainly is. I wrote that 20-some years ago when I was living in New York, and I had come up with what I thought was a very nice, graceful Brazilian-style melody, and I had written a couple sets of lyrics to it that had actual context, but nothing seemed to really fire my imagination until one night I began to doodle around with my voice and sang the name of Van Lingle Mungo, and then, of course, my path was clear. It became a litany of names, baseball players from World War II era.
Can you play a verse of that?
Well, I'll play a little bit of it. You hear what I'm talking about, yeah. Whitey Karowski, Max Lanier, Eddie Waitkus, and Johnny Vandermeer. Danny Gardella. Van Lingle Mungo. Augie Bergamo. Sigmund Jakuki, Big Johnny Mize, and Barney McCoskey, Hal Trosky, and so on.
It's interesting. It's such a wistful little melody, you know.
It's sad. It's not a happy, dancey little song. It's not tearfully sad, but it does. It brings a lump to one's throat if you remember those World War II baseball days. My favorite comment about the song came from somebody in a club once after I'd finished singing it. And they said, you know that song you sang about your childhood heroes and your childhood friends? And I said, yes. And I thought to myself, this guy really understands. That's exactly what the song's about. He said, you know, one of those guys is a ball player.
That's great.
I didn't even ask him which one. I didn't even want to know. You know.
For quite a while, you accompanied singers. You've played with some terrific singers. You played with Carmen McRae, Jimmy Rushing, Anita O'Day, to name a few. Singers always complain that there aren't songwriters writing good songs like there used to be, and that there isn't a lot of good contemporary material for them to perform. Did hearing complaints like that inspire you to start writing more songs?
Well, not really. I became interested in writing songs. You're right. You caught the period anyway. When I was very busy as an accompanist in New York, and I began to pay attention to the repertoire that I was dealing with. I began to look at it critically and think about how it would feel to write some lyrics. I hadn't ever thought about being a lyric writer.
How did you start to sing in public?
I had been a professional sideman in all kinds of contexts for maybe 25 years before I ever screwed up the courage to sing in front of people. And it was mainly self-defense, I guess, or in a way, because I had written a lot of songs and nobody was singing them, and I had written them for other people to sing, never dreaming to sing them myself. I finally realized that in order for them to even get heard, I would have to sing them. So my first exercises in singing were to demo my own songs. And then my friends, namely Jack Sheldon in Los Angeles, was the main instigator, would push me to sing them in front of people. I'd be playing with Jack's band, and he would say, "And now Dave Frischberg's going to sing his latest song," and there was nothing I could do except acquiesce.
Can you play one of those early songs that you started performing?
Oh, I used to do I'm Hip all the time, you know. I'm hip, I'm no square, I'm alert, I'm awake, I'm aware. I am always on the scene, making the rounds and digging the sounds. I read Billboard magazine, 'cause I'm hip. Well, that song, of course, Blossom Dearie recorded that 3 or 4 times at least. She always says, Bob Doro and Dave Frischberg wrote that song, I'm Hip, but I'm the one who made it famous.
When you started to sing yourself, were you very self-conscious? I mean, after all, you'd accompany these really great singers. Did you feel self-conscious about singing yourself?
Well, I had different funny ideas about singing. In the first place, being a professional accompanist for so many years, it was my reflex to regard singers as the enemy. And here I was, one of them. You know, I'm one of them. I did feel self-conscious about singing at first, but I guess I'm really a ham, because as soon as I got the message that people really liked it and responded to it, then I wanted to sing again and more, and now I really like it. I found a kind of a new way to go, and I'm very happy I did it. Kind of revived my interest in the music business, too.
You said you saw the singer as the enemy when you were an accompanist? You want to explain that?
Yeah, well, that was kind of a little joke. I was being...
Yeah, but it comes from truth. What did you mean?
Well, sure. Well, you know, the singers and their accompanists are always adversaries.
Oh, over what kinds of issues?
Over tempos and so forth. Over accompanying conventions and things like that. Sure, it was always a battle with singers.
You have a kind of voice that seems to really be an extension of your personality. I mean, I'd guess, like, having heard a lot of your records, that I knew something about you, rightly or wrongly. But I'm wondering if you ever tried to sound like anybody else when you were first starting to sing.
No, I really didn't. I was so appalled at my own amateurish singing that what I was really trying to do was learn how to sing in tune and how to get some of the basic techniques of voice production down. And I never tried to sound like anybody. However, that's not to say that other singers didn't influence me. For instance, I'd have to say that Ray Charles influenced me, but it would be stupid to suggest that I tried to sound like Ray Charles or Nat Cole.
Mm-hmm.
One of the singers that influenced me the most was Bing Crosby, and that's just from a standpoint of listening to him deliver a lyric and make a song come to life without drawing attention to himself. I think that's always appealed to me. I've always admired the singers who could direct my attention to the music that was happening, instead of to their own virtuosity.
More from David Frischberg on the next Fresh Air. In the meantime, here's something from his new album, Can't Take You Nowhere.
You knock back the schnapps, you talk back to cops, you walk in the room and conversation stops. I can't take you nowhere. No, I can't take you nowhere. You stagger, you sag, you're half in the bag. One glass of beer and you're a total drag. I can't take you nowhere. No, I can't take you nowhere. I buy three or four, you mooch plenty more. The check comes around and you are out the door. I can't take you nowhere. No, I can't take you nowhere.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we're following news from Israel. The Israeli army has cut off press access to many parts of the West Bank where there have been bloody protests. Also, reaction in Nicaragua and in Washington to yesterday's defeat in the House of Representatives of a package of non-lethal aid to the Nicaraguan Contras that it was thought would be approved. We have a preview of the South Carolina primary among the Republicans from reporter Nina Totenberg. And we also take a look ahead at probably the most important thing that's happening in the country right now. You know what that is, Terry?
What is it?
Spring training.
Of course.
Has begun in Florida.
Okay. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The final competition between the women figure skaters at the Calgary Olympic Games attracted the largest Saturday night television viewing audience since the broadcast of Roots. Critic at large Laurie Stone says that much of the judging and the television commentary for the sport was as shaky as a 3.0 performance.
The way I saw the Olympics, the important battle wasn't between the competitors, but between women athletes, particularly figure skaters, and retro judges and reporters. Debbie Thomas, a Stanford pre-med student, is hardly street smart, as a flustered Dick Button recently described her. But her blackness, to which he was really referring, does have meaning. Her minority face and form slice through a white, staid aesthetic. This, combined with her power style, makes her presence radical. Unlike the majority of women skaters, Thomas doesn't jiggle her hips or paste a love-me expression on her face or cast herself in the role of the fragile flower. Her fast-paced dance, full of triple leaps and serpentine footwork, and her frequent choice of rocking, hard-driving music, celebrate strength, poise, and the lyricism of self-possession. What lousy luck that she faltered Saturday night. If she'd skated her full-out best, she would likely have won. She was leading the competition. The judges had been broadly criticized for undervaluing the artistic merit of her brilliant short program. Button and Peggy Fleming, hardly flag-bearers for the avant-garde, had noted the resistance of judges to innovation, particularly to the bold, exhilarating ice dancing of the Duchesnes who skated for France. They performed an openly erotic tango, as opposed to the preferred kittenish one, and in their wild, harsh, long program, abandoned romantic roles and partnered each other equally. By Saturday night, the judges appeared to have gotten the message. Katerina Witt, whose program lacked technical virtuosity but who skated without mishap and with customary seductiveness, earned respectable but beatable marks. By leaving room for Thomas to top her, the judges showed they were ready to be fair, but they didn't get the chance. Landing the second triple jump in her triple-triple combination, both of Thomas's feet touched the ice, and it was downhill from there. Witt got the gold. The biggest winner, though, was Japan's Midori Ito, who, in the wake of Thomas's lead, gave us another minority face and form and presented another athletically adventurous and graceful performance, with triples so high they hovered in midair. Ito's uninhibited tears of joy were a tonic, too, amid the customary restraint, a form of feminine detachment as staged as the flirting. Will Thomas and Ito do for women's figure skating what Martina did for women's tennis? Not if ABC's commentators have anything to do with it. Button's tongue would fall off if he had to say the word woman. Fleming, who could barely contain her dislike of Thomas's style, managed to be supportive when Debbie lost, and Jim McKay drooled every time he spotted little Katya, the 16-year-old Russian pairs champ. Endlessly, the female skaters were little girls, lovely girls, poor girls. While Witt made herself odious by straining for glamour, she was still ill-served by the depiction of her beauty as a weapon against Thomas, and then, ultimate sliming, as a prize for skier Alberto Tomba. Put another female in the picture, and you get a catfight. Put a man in the picture, and the woman is no longer even an athlete. Talk about women wriggling under the heel. The most naked parent-from-hell moment was Jill Trenery's father declaring he'd just as soon she didn't skate. Go, Jill, skate your heart out. Skate his heart out. The one antidote I saw to ABC's swill came from Jack Whitaker. After watching Witt and Thomas, he credited the East German for cracking the mold of the dowdy Sportfrau, and he said he'd love to have Thomas as his family doctor.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, David Frischberg returns to the piano for part two of our conversation, and we find out why not to believe everything he sings. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review Your Eyes, the second big band album by the Norwegian pianist and composer Per Husby. And television critic David Bianculli will turn historian and try to determine the precise moment that moonlighting began its fall. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.